The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day.
This is Edgar Lustgarten introducing today's London Forum and the two members of Parliament who are our speakers. Anthony Crossland is Labour, and before his election, he was a lecturer in economics at Oxford. Reginald Maudling is Conservative, and before his election, he was head of the economic section of the Conservative Research Department. I'm telling you these little bits of their past history because it has a considerable bearing on the problem we're going to discuss, Britain's economic problem. For several years back, you know, average people have thought that Britain's economic problem could be summed up in two words, dollar gap. But today we're being told that the dollar gap is closed, and in the same breath we're being told that a serious, a grave economic problem is still with us. And what most people here would like to know, and what I imagine quite a lot of overseas listeners would like to know, is this. If we have indeed solved the dollar problem, if we have indeed closed the dollar gap, what exactly is the trouble now? What are we up against? Crossland, do you think you could start by throwing some light on this for us?
Well, I could, but before I do that, I would like to emphasize just how completely, for the moment, we have solved the dollar gap. The increase in our gold reserves between 1949 and this year, and the change from a very large deficit on the dollar account to a natural surplus in the first 6 months of this year. It does seem to have been a quite spectacular change. And it is, in fact, due to a considerable extent to the policies of this country. It's sometimes said that Britain has contributed very little, and that it's all to the credit of the rest of the sterling area. In fact, if you take the first 6 months of 1949 and compare that with the first 6 months of 1950, you see that the United Kingdom contributed more to the improvement than the rest of the sterling area.
Now, Crossland, I notice, says that that is due to the policies of this country, and Maudling, I take that to be a delicate way of saying it is due to the policy of the Labour Party. What have you got to say about that?
I also took that to be his meaning, and I'm grateful for his delicacy between one opponent and another. I would be the first to admit that the change in the state of our gold reserves has been dramatic. And I would also admit that I was wrong in not anticipating that it would be so dramatic. And I think it's one up to Sir Stafford Cripps that he was right, and most economists in this country were wrong. Personally, I think it is to be attributed rather less to the policies of the government than to the activities of enterprise in this country, 80% of which still remains, as we know, private enterprise. But I do think it is unwise, you know, to overestimate the degree or to know the permanence of the closing of the dollar gap. You said, Carlson, just now, that in the first half of this year, the United Kingdom contributed more to the improvement in the dollar situation, the gold situation, than the rest of the sterling area. But isn't it also true that the improvement was very largely in invisible items of payment, and not in visible trade? Our balance of trade in physical, visible items got worse, if anything, in that period.
Well, I think that's true if you take the British balance of payments with the rest of the world, but if you just take the dollar gap by itself, although invisible certainly improved to a great extent, it is very important indeed, the main part of the improvement in our actual dollar balance was in the visible figures. And the main part of that, in fact, was due to import cuts, both on the part of Britain and on the part of the rest of the sterling area. In fact, dollar exports have gone very well in the last few months, and I should hate to claim the sole credit of that for the government. I'm perfectly prepared to share it, in some degree at any rate, with private enterprise. But the main part of the improvement between the two periods, so far as dollars were concerned, was in import cuts. And I do very strongly think that these import cuts, which have been decisive, wouldn't have taken place but for government policy and but for government controls.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because the import cuts have been true, carried out in this country, but also in the other dominions. And the other dominions have made a very great contribution indeed, often at great inconvenience to themselves. Take Australia, for example. I believe much of the present inflation in Australia is due to the fact that they exercise very great restraint over their dollar imports. If they could have more dollar goods, they'd have less inflation. They did play an immense part in solving or helping to solve temporarily this problem.
I don't want to introduce into this extremely generous discussion any note which might lead to bitterness, but I want to put this question to Crossland, and that is this. Supposing that a Conservative government had been in power during the period in which the dollar gap has been in fact closed, do you think, and here we come down right to brass tacks, do you think the dollar gap would have been closed?
No, I'm quite certain in my own mind that it wouldn't have been closed, just to introduce an edge of controversy. I think that for two reasons. Partly that I don't think that a Conservative government would have been willing to control imports as ruthlessly as in fact we have done, and as in fact has been proved necessary to closing the dollar gap. And secondly, I don't think that Conservative governments would have been willing to operate their controls on the home economy, on private enterprise, sufficiently ruthlessly to compel a larger proportion of our total production, our total output, into the export markets, as in fact we have achieved.
Role modelling?
I often think, you know, that ruthlessness in the exercise of controls really is a conceals incompetence in the administration of them. I don't really believe that this exercise of internal economic control has had much to do with it. But if I can come to another point, what worries me is this, that as our balance of payments improves, always our internal price problem seems to get worse. A world inflation, world rising prices, seems to coincide with an improvement of our gold reserves. But world falling prices means that our gold reserves get worse. But we have this dilemma. Either we're going to have a balance of payments problem or an inflation problem. We seem to be moving now from the problem, temporarily, of the balance of payments to the problem of new and renewed inflation. That's what worries me. Would you agree with that one?
I think that's very true. I think that the dilemma is very, very much as you stated. Although, just before I say a word about that, it's well to remember that the improvement in our dollar balance between the first half of 49 and the first half of 50 in fact took place before Korea and before the world rearmament boom and before the present commodity boom reached its the extreme limits of the last two or three months.
Yes, but there was a short-term covering of commitment, a short-term bear covering, I think the economists call it, in that period, which died away in the middle of this year.
Yes, that's quite true. But at any rate, it did precede the fantastic commodity boom that's going on now. And as I said, in fact, the improvement was largely due not to our earning more by our exports so much as the decision to cut imports for various reasons.
Anyway, Crossland, this gives us an opportunity of putting the question again, which I put to you at the beginning and you were kind enough to say you would answer later. And that was, what light can you throw on the new problem that's before us? What is the new British economic problem?
Well, the new British economic problem, and I think that Maudling would agree with me here probably, is now not for the moment the problem of how to settle the dollar gap, not for the moment the problem of our foreign trade at all. It is the problem of the impact of rearmament on our own economy, and certainly not merely the impact of rearmament in this country, but also the impact on us of rearmament in America, for instance, which is having the effect of driving up commodity prices to their present level. That seems to me the present problem. I don't think that Maudling and I would disagree on that at all.
Is that in fact agreed, Maudling?
Yes, I think the problem of rising prices in this country, and I think in most other countries, is the most important problem at the moment. Various factors contribute. One, the long-term effects of devaluation, which are now coming home completely to roost. Secondly, international competition for raw materials. Thirdly, internal competition between the demands of rearmament and the demands of the consumer. And fourthly, wage claims, which I think must be granted to a considerable extent over the next few months.
Is this, Crossland, what the average person would put into terms of cost of living?
This is certainly what the average person would put into terms of cost of living, I agree. And to the average person, it certainly is by far the most important immediate problem that he's concerned about. I think, though, that it's only part of the general problem of how Britain in particular, and if it comes to the rest of the world, is to finance an additional large burden of rearmament. It seems to me that the cost of living is part, in a sense, of the wider problem. And although the burden manifests itself in a rising cost of living to a considerable extent, I think one ought first to discuss just where the rearmament is coming from, where the resources which we're now going to spend on rearmament are to come from.
Yes, indeed. One of the things I thought perhaps we might discuss even before that was how far this problem has gone up to now. For example, how far has inflation reached? Would you, Maudling, say that it's gone a very great distance?
Well, there seem to be two opinions about how far inflation has gone, or in other words, how high prices have gone. One is the opinion of my wife, who tells me that prices have been going up very fast, and I agree with her when I go to the shops. The other is the opinion of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who told us in the House of Commons this afternoon that the cost of living has only risen by about tuppence in the pound.
Then there's the cost of living index, which keeps going down and down and down, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's on a sensitive point to certain members of the opposing party. Perhaps we might ask Crossland whether he thinks the cost of living is going up or down, or perhaps both at once. You never know.
Well, Crossland, tell us.
Well, Maudling, first of all, you posed a very difficult problem because you faced me with a choice of loyalties. I have to side either with your wife, whom alas I don't know, but from afar I admire, or with my own chance of the exchequer. And it is a particularly difficult problem. So far as the cost of living is concerned, I don't think, in fact, there is any doubt that, at any rate, taking a few months together, it is going up. I certainly don't dispute that, nor do I dispute that it's an absolutely vital problem. What I would say about inflation, in respect of this rise in the cost of living, though, is this, that the reason why our cost of living is going up at the moment in this country is almost entirely due to inflation abroad and not to inflation at home. I shouldn't say that we had any inflation at home now. I think that we're just suffering from the effects of inflation in other countries, and certainly will continue to suffer for the next few months.
I should not doubt that. I should say the pressure already of competitive demand between manufacturers for metals, for example, and other material for the increased rearmament program has had some effect. And the increase in wage rates, which has gone on and is bound to go on to some extent, to an increasing extent, is already having an effect in this country in that it's putting more money in people's pockets. If you have more money in people's pockets and less things for them to buy, then you get rising prices, as I understand it. That really is, would you agree that that's what inflation really means to the ordinary housewife or...
Well, I agree that if you have that situation, then you'll have rising prices. But I don't really agree with your analysis on that. The rise in wages in this country in the last year has been infinitesimal. It's been far lower than anybody expected when these things were discussed after devaluation. It's been far lower than anybody then expected. And really, wages have been pretty constant in the last year in this country. There is a certain competition, I agree, amongst manufacturers for raw materials, but I don't think as yet that may become a serious problem. At the moment, rearmament hasn't had much effect on this country.
Well, you ask them in Birmingham, if you heard they say. I think they'll disagree on that one. You ask people who are trying to fabricate aluminium, what's happening about the demand for raw aluminium. I think it's already got underway. And so far, very few firm contracts for munitions, as far as I know, have been placed. We're just in the early stages of the rearmament demand. And I think that will come upon us, or ought to come upon us, very soon, and rather drastically.
Well, it seems to me the position we've reached is this, that whether we get it by infection from abroad, or whether it's a homegrown product, we are agreed that there is a certain degree of inflation at the present time. And now, modelling the point you're just making, brings us back to what Crossland was coming to a few minutes ago, and that is, how do you pay for rearmament? Crossland, you were about to make that point, and I would like you, if you would, to do it now.
Well, I'm glad to make the point, although I'm bound to make it in a form which... At any rate, it gives some credit to the present government. I think that the only thing which makes rearmament an even bearable burden for us in this country is the rate of increase in our productivity every year. This really fantastic fact that year by year our total output is going up by, well, we can quarrel about the figures, there are disputes, but it's going up by something like 5, 6, 7% a year. This is just about double the rate at which it went up before the war. I personally think this is very largely due to rearmament plus controls. I think that that's what has produced this basically healthy economy. And I think that owing to this rise, we are at any rate in a position to pay for rearmament, probably, without any really significant cut anywhere else. In other words, out of our increased production year by year.
Well, I wish I could agree with that. I think it's a very difficult problem, which I've been trying to understand. I don't believe that production has increased by as much as 8 or 9% as is quoted. Undoubtedly, it has been going up and will continue to go up, though the rate of increase is bound to be slowed down, partly by raw material shortages and partly by the upset of converting factories from making motor cars or whatever it may be to armored cars or tanks. That is bound to slow down the increase in the rate of production, therefore will slow down the increase in the national income. And I doubt if we will produce enough over the next year to meet our rearmament requirements without having to cut back on other forms of consumption. Certainly in some physical items, sheet, steel, timber, and these things, there will have to be a diversion from manufacture for civilians to manufacture for the armed forces. See, we can't avoid that, can we?
Well, but you say that we've got to have some increase in consumption, but then what sort of an increase in... I beg your pardon, you said we've got to have some sort of a fall in consumption. But where is the falling consumption to be felt? Because you did say some time back that you thought that wages ought to go up, for example. It is rather difficult to see how you should have a fall in consumption and yet at the same time say that wages are bound to go up and should go up.
Well, it's difficult, but I think it seems to me some of the economic facts of life that wages are going to go up in this country as they are in every other country in the world for the next few months. And as for reducing consumption, are bound to be fewer motor cars, fewer radio sets, fewer pots and pans. Everything that takes either metal or metal fabricating capacity is bound to become more difficult to acquire if our rearmament program is going to be as big as I fear it's got to be.